A small Puerto Rican-looking woman took his order. I decided to wait until he'd finished eating, then do my, "Hello, Tom. Well, well, fancy seeing you here, bit." But my plan got cut short as he suddenly stood up and turned towards the door. Along with a very pissed-off waitress, I watched him cross the road and run up a side street, losing him in the moisture on the windows and the shadow of the awning. He must have seen me. I got up and paid my money to Rear of the Year, getting an extra big and friendly, "Bye, sweetie," when she saw the size of tip I'd left on my saucer. Tom had run towards home, so I headed in the direction of All Saints Road, past reggae music stores and plumbers' shops. His address was a flat in a yellow-painted, stucco-fronted building just off All Saints. Going by the array of bell pushes at the front door, it looked like there were 8 flats in the building, which meant each one must have been the size of a broom cupboard. Most houses in the street had been converted into flats and were painted black, green or yellow, with grimy windows covered by dirty old netting which drooped in the middle. I bet this road wasn't in the film. I went to press the button for his flat, number 4. But the wiring hanging out of the intercom was rusted and frayed. Some names were slotted into the recesses on torn pieces of paper, but half of them, like flat 4, didn't even have that. As I rang the bell, I could hear the slight buzz of an electric current. Chances were the thing did work. I waited, stamping my feet and digging my hands into my jacket, but there was no answer. I wasn't expecting one from the intercom, but thought there might have been a shout or a face at a window. Eventually, a curtain twitched on the 3rd floor. I rang again. Nothing. It was turning out to be more amusing than frustrating. Tom just wasn't cut out for this sort of thing. If you want to do a runner, you don't head straight home. E4 would have had no trouble pinning him down. I found myself smiling as I thought of him up there, hoping I'd just go away and that everything would be all right. Looking up again at the dirty window, I made sure that whoever was watching would hear me clunking down the steps, really tearing the arse out of it so they'd know I'd given up. Walking back the way I'd come, I hung around at the junction with All Saints, knowing that he'd leave sooner or later. It was the wrong thing to do, so he was bound to do it. He might have the skill to hack into and download whatever it was in this Finnish house, but when it came to common sense, he had trouble inserting the disc, let alone playing the game. Loitering in the doorway of a derelict shop, I was facing a massive pop art mural that covered the whole gable end of a building. Reggae music blared from a shop as 2 teenagers came out and danced their way along the road, sharing a cigarette. My own breath was doing a good imitation of smoke in the cold air. I wasn't too sure that I'd be able to see Tom if he tried to do a bunk over the back of the house, but he was on the 3rd floor, so it would be quite difficult for him. From what I'd seen of him, even if he'd been on the ground floor, it would have been a bit of a challenge. I must have looked like the local loony to the kids, grinning broadly as they thought about him trying to get himself over a 6-foot wall. I wouldn't want Mancini as a wingman. Sure enough, 20 cold, boring minutes later, out he came. Still with no coat on, hands tucked under his armpits, not exactly running, but moving quickly. I didn't even have to follow him. He was coming towards me, probably on his way to screw up even more by going straight back to the cafe. I stepped out in front of him, and his look of horror said it all. "Hello, Tom." At first, he didn't move. He just stood there, rooted to the spot, then he half turned away, screwing up his face and looking down at the pavement, like a dog that thinks it's going to get hit.
"Please don't hurt me. I didn't say nothing to no one. On my life, promise."
"It's all right, Tom," I said. "I have nothing to do with those people now. That's not why I'm here." Chapter 14. "Tell you what," I said. "Let's go back to your flat. Get the kettle on and have a chat." I was trying to sound nice, but he knew I wasn't offering him a choice. I put an arm around his shoulder and he stiffened. "Come on, mate. Let's have a brew. and I'll tell you what this is all about. It's too cold out here. Being only about 5'5", it was easy to get my arm around. I could feel the softness of his body. He hadn't shaved for a few days, and the result wasn't bristle, but the sort of thing you could fill a duvet with. I started to make small talk as we walked, trying to make him feel at ease. Also, this meeting needed to look a bit more normal to any third party nosing out of their window. "How long have you been living round here, then, Tom?" He kept his head down, studying the paving slabs. As we passed the multicoloured houses, I noticed he was shaking.
"About a year, I suppose."
"Hey, I called your flat earlier on, and a woman answered. She your girlfriend?"
"Janice? Yeah."
There was a gap of a second or two before he stopped walking and looked up at me.
"Look, mate, I've never ever said nothing to no one about any of that stuff. Not a word. I swear on my mother's life. I haven't even told you—"
"Tom, all I want to do is talk. I've got a proposition for you. Let's just sit down, have a brew and a chat." He nodded as I got us both walking again. "I think you'll like what you hear. Come on, get the kettle on." We got to the house and walked up the 4 or 5 stone steps to the door. Tom fumbled for his key, which was tied to an old bit of nylon string, his hand shaking as he tried to get it into the keyhole. He still thought he was going to get hammered. I decided to let him think it. Maybe it would lighten him up when he finally realized I wasn't here to put him in hospital. It was just as cold in the hallway as it was outside. The threadbare, dirty carpet matched the damp, peeling walls. An old-fashioned pram blocked the hall, and I could hear what sounded like its passenger screaming in the flat to the left, trying to make more noise than the TV talk show sharing his room. Breathing in to pass the pram and get to the stairs, I felt quite cheerful. Even my house smelled better than this. Heat rises, but not in this place. Number 4 had its own small landing, with paint peeling off the door and banisters. He managed to get the key straight in the lock, and the door opened into what I supposed was the living room. Dirty grey net curtains made the dirty grey light from outside even gloomier. MFI's flat pack division had done well out of Tom. Shiny, waxed pine shone everywhere in the small room. Even the 2-seater settee had wooden arms. The rest of the place was in a bad way. More damp walls, worn carpet, and cold. The fireplace was boarded up, and a mains gas fire was stuck in its place, just gagging to be turned on. I could still see my breath. A 10-year-old wood veneer TV stood on a waxed pine stand in the corner, with a video machine underneath, the LEDs flashing all the zeros, and a dozen or so videos stacked next to it on the floor. To the right of that was a Sony PlayStation, with a stack of games scattered around it, and the world's oldest PC. The buff-coloured plastic was dark and dirty, and the vents at the back were so black it looked like it ran on diesel. Its keyboard was really worn. I could only just make out the instructions on the keys. Not the best of equipment for such a high-tech guy, but very good news for me. It would have been harder to get him to come along if he was making a fortune and living in a penthouse. The need for money makes people do things they would never normally dream of. I was a bit of an expert on that front. We both stood there, and I could feel his embarrassment. I broke the silence. "Put the kettle on, mate, and I'll get the fire going, eh?" He walked into a tiny kitchen off the main room, and I heard coins getting fed into a meter, and the knob turning to give us some gas. I heard the tap filling up the kettle as I threw my money on the settee and tried to light the fire, clicking the pilot light several times before the gas ignited with a whoomph. Opposite was another door that was open about 6 inches. MFI hadn't got round to the bedroom. A mattress lay on the floor, the duvet pulled aside, dangerously close to a portable Kala gas heater. The only other furniture seemed to be a digital alarm clock lying on the floor. It felt just like home. There was no telling where the bathroom was. but I reckoned it would be on the other side of the kitchen somewhere. In fact, it was probably part of the kitchen. I stayed down with the fire for a while to warm up.
So what are you doing with yourself now, Tom? Still in the computer business?
At last, there was a spark of life from him. He hadn't been filled in, and I was taking an interest in his subject. He stuck his chubby head into the living room. I'd forgotten how it jutted backwards and forwards like a cockerel's when he larged it.
Yeah, I've got a few irons in the fire, know what I mean? Games, that's where the money is, mate. I've got a few movers and shakers in the business gagging for my ideas, know what I mean? Gagging.
I was still kneeling down, rubbing my hands by the flames.
That's really good to hear, Tom.
Yeah, things are sweet. This is just temporary, while I decide who to sell my idea to. Then it's gravy time. Look for a house to buy, cash, of course, then start my own show. Know what I mean?
I nodded, knowing exactly what he meant. He had no money, no job, and was still full of bullshit. He was going to like what I was about to tell him. His head disappeared back into the kitchen, and things started to be washed up. Standing up to go over to the settee, I saw a pile of plain white cards on the mantelpiece. The top two had lipstick kisses and a handwritten message on. I hope you like my dirty panties. Love, Juicy Lucy. Kiss, kiss. I picked one up. At least the lipstick was genuine. I raised my voice as I walked over to the settee.
How long have you been with Janice?
She sort of moved in a couple of months ago.
What does she do?
Just part-time at Tesco's. Bits and pieces, you know?
He stuck his head around the door again.
Sugar?
No, just some milk will be fine.
He came in with two mugs and put them on the not-so-new carpet. Sitting on the floor by the fire, facing towards me on the settee, he passed mine over. His, I noticed, was without milk. I saw him clock the open bedroom door and worry whether I'd seen what lay beyond it. We both picked up our tea at the same time.
Don't worry about it, mate. I spent my childhood living in places like this. Maybe I can help you find somewhere better. Until the game thing kicks in.
He tried to sip his tea as his eyes flicked towards the Mickey Mouse alarm on top of the fire. Time to get down to business.
By the looks of it, things ain't that good, are they? You on the social?
Jack the Lad came back with a grin.
Yeah? Who ain't? I mean, free money. Madness not to. Am I right or what?
He went back to concentrating on his tea.
Tom, I think I can help. I've been offered a job that would earn you enough to buy a flat and pay any debts outright.
He didn't trust me. A fair one.
It wasn't as if he knew me as Mr. Nice Guy.
His eyes were still checking Mickey Mouse now and again.
How much?
He tried to make it sound casual, but didn't quite pull it off. I avoided burning my lips on my tea and took a sip. It was horrible. It should have been in a scent bottle, not a mug.
I don't exactly know yet. But I reckon your share would be at least 130,000.
Cash.
That's the minimum.
All I need is a week of your time. 2 weeks at the most. I didn't have a clue how long the job was going to take, but once I got him to Finland, what could he do if it took longer? Getting him there was priority number one at the moment.
Is it legal? I ain't doing anything dodgy, mate. I don't want any more trouble. I'm not getting banged up again, know what I mean?
My brew went back on the carpet. It was shit anyway.
Look. First of all, my name is Nick. I know it's not illegal. I don't want to go to prison either. It's just that I've been given this opportunity and I need someone brilliant with computers. I thought of you.
Why not?
I'd rather you had the money than anyone else. You even get a free trip to Finland out of it.
Finland?
Jack the Lad was returning once again, head jutting.
Hey! Everyone is online up there. It's a cold, know what I mean, Nick? Too cold, like, nothing else to do.
He laughed. I laughed along with him as his eyes moved over to Mickey again. Tom, do you need to be somewhere else?
Nah, you're all right. It's just that Janice is home soon, and the fact is, well, she don't know nothing. You know, my old work, getting banged up, all that stuff. I haven't really got round to telling her. I'm just a bit worried that, you know, if she came in and you said something.
Hey, no problems, I'll keep quiet.
Tell you what, when she comes in, I'll just say that I've got a small computer firm and I'm offering you a couple of weeks' work up in Scotland, testing systems. How's that sound?
Nice one. But what's the form? You know, what are you after in Finland?
It's very, very simple. All we need is to access a system and then download some stuff. Until we get there, I don't know what, how, and when.
He immediately looked worried. I had to get in there straight away. I needed some lies.
It's not what you're thinking. It is legitimate. All we're going to do is find out about some new photocopier technology. And we've got to do it in a totally legal way, otherwise the money men don't want to know.
I couldn't think of anything more boring and non-threatening than a photocopier, and I waited for a bolt of something to come at me through the window. God must have been asleep, or had all his lightning still in the freezer. I carried on before Tom had a chance to think about it and ask questions. I can get us into the place, I went on. But I need someone who knows what the fuck they're looking at once we're in front of one of those things. I pointed at the heap of crap in the corner that was trying to look like a computer. He didn't say anything, but looked at his greasy monitor screen, maybe thinking of the boiled sweet-coloured Power Mac and matching iMac laptop he could buy with his cut.
Everything will be laid on when we get there, Tom. They know where the place is. All you've got to do is access and download it. Not steal, mind, just copy. Easy money.
I braced myself in case God had stirred in time to hear that last bit. Tom fidgeted on the carpet, so I kept going for it before God woke up or Janice got home.
You know as much as me now, mate. I'm going half on the money with you. 130 grand. Maybe more if we get the job done quickly. That's a shitload of cash, Tom.
I paused to let him visualize a wheelbarrow full of tenners. 15 seconds was enough.
Chance of a lifetime, Tom.
I sounded like a double glazing salesman.
If you don't take it, someone else will.
I settled back on the settee to signal that the pitch was over. The next stage would be a shed full of intimidation to make him come with me if the soft soaping failed.
You absolutely sure it's safe, Nick? I mean, banged up. I don't want that again. Things are sweet here, know what I mean? I'm going to be earning big bucks soon.
Explaining to him that I knew he was bullshitting would have to wait until I read him his horoscope.
Look, mate, even if it was illegal, there's no such thing as prison when it comes to these jobs. Think about it. If they discover that you found out about their poxy photocopier, are they really going to go to the police? Are they fuck? Think about the shareholders. Think about the bad publicity. It doesn't work like that, mate. Trust me. What happened to you before was different. That was government business. I couldn't help my curiosity. By the way, what was it they caught you doing up at Menwith? He started to get edgy.
Nah, mate, I ain't saying nothing. I've done my time. I don't say nothing to nobody. I never want to go back.
He was starting to sound like an old record. He was in a state. I knew he wanted the money, but he was struggling to make a decision. Time for a new tack.
I tell you what, why don't you just come with me anyway? Have a look, and if you don't like it, you can come back. I'm not trying to fuck up your life, mate. I'm just trying to do us both a favour.
He was shifting from one buttock to another.
I don't know. Janice wouldn't like it.
I moved forward once again on the settee so my arse was on the edge and went conspiratorial.
Janice doesn't need to know. Just say you're going to Scotland. Easy.
The hiss of the gas fire could be heard clearly above my whisper. I decided I'd give him a bit more incentive.
Where's your toilet, Tom?
Through the kitchen. You'll see the door.
I stood up and took my bag with me.
Nothing personal, I said. Work stuff, you know?
He nodded, and I didn't really know if he understood or not, because I didn't.
I went into the toilet. I'd been right. The bathroom was part of the kitchen, partitioned off by a bit of plasterboard so the landlord could claim more rooms and charge the DHSS a fortune for people to live here. I sat on the pan and counted out $6,000 from the dollars. I was about to shove it in my pocket when I decided to calm down a bit and put $2,000 back in the bag. Pulling the flush, I came out talking.
All I know is that it's an easy job. But I need you, Tom. And if you're honest, you need the money as much as I do. Look, this is what I want to do for you.
Reaching into my pocket, I pulled out the $4,000, making sure I rolled it with my other hand to make it look and sound extra attractive. He tried hard to stop himself looking at it. Even this amount could probably change his life.
This is how I'm getting paid. US dollars. Here's $4,000. Take it. It's a gift. Pay your bills, whatever you want. What more can I say? I'm going to go and do the job anyway. If you come in with me, though, I need to know today. I can't fuck about.
If he didn't give me a yes by this evening, it would be horoscope time. He'd still get paid. He just wouldn't enjoy the work so much. He fingered the money and had to split it in half to get it into his jean pockets. He tried to put a serious business expression on his face. It wasn't working.
Nice one. Thanks, Nick. Thanks a lot.
Whatever happened, he could have the money. It made me feel good, and with everything else going down the tubes in my life, I needed that. But I needed to make sure he didn't fuck up with it and let it be traced back to me.
Don't go to the bank to change it or make a deposit. They'll think you're a drug dealer, especially with an address round here.
His smile broadened.
Take it to a few bureaux de change. The rates will be shit, but there you go. Have a nice day out. Hire a taxi, you can afford it. Just don't change any more than $300 at a time. Oh, and for fuck's sake, buy yourself a warm coat.
He looked up and the grin turned into a laugh as he did his cockerel impression. It stopped just as quickly at the sound of a key going into the door lock.
Shit, it's Janice. Don't say Jack. Promise me, Nick.
He stood up and made sure his sweatshirt was covering the two bulges in his cargoes. I joined him, and we waited in front of the fire as if the Queen was about to visit. She opened the door, felt the heat, and looked straight at Tom, ignoring me completely.
Have you picked up the laundry?
Heading towards the kitchen, she started throwing off her brown greatcoat. Tom grimaced an apology at me as he replied.
Oh, nah, it wasn't ready. The dryers were broken. I'm going to pick it up in a minute. This is Nick. He's the one that called, you know, this morning.
She threw her coat onto the arm of the settee, looking at me. I gave a smile and said,
Hello, nice to meet you.
Hello,
she grunted.
You found him then?
And disappeared into the kitchen. Janice was mid-twenties. Not unattractive, not attractive, just sort of ordinary. Her hair was pulled back in a ponytail, slightly longer than Tom's. It wasn't exactly greasy, but had that not-washed-today look. She was also wearing just a bit too much makeup, and there was a line around her chin where it stopped. I sat back down, but Tom stayed standing by the fire, not really knowing what to say to me about his obnoxious girlfriend. In the kitchen, cupboard doors were banged as she made her presence felt. She came back into the living room with a bar of fruit and nuts and a can of Coke. Pushing the coats onto the floor, she plonked herself on the settee next to me, pulled the foil off the chocolate, opened the can and started attacking both. The noise of her drinking would have made a thirsty bricklayer proud. Between gulps, she pointed at the mantelpiece.
Tom, pass me the cards.
He did as he was told.
We both watched as she pulled out a lipstick from her coat pocket and threw it on her lips. Then, while she slurped and munched, she kissed the remaining blank cards. She looked up and stared at me for a few moments, then turned to Tom.
Pass me the rest.
He picked up an A4 envelope near the fire and passed it over, red with embarrassment. Pouring the white cards onto the floor, she started to reapply the red stuff and kiss away. The signing was obviously done later, during a gentler moment. We weren't going to get any more talking done. It was time for me to leave.
Thanks for the tea, Tom. I think I'll be off now. Nice to meet you, Janice.
She nodded, not bothering to look up. Tom looked nervously at me, then at Janice's head.
As I got to my feet and picked up the bag, he blurted,
"Tell you what, I'll walk down with you. I've got to collect the laundry anyway."
We didn't speak as we walked down the stairs. I knew what I wanted to say, but what was the point? Someone calling your girlfriend an obnoxious dog wouldn't exactly induce you to go away with him. As we walked back towards All Saints Road, he stammered,
"It's not her, you know, Juicy Lucy. She gets a tenner for every 200. This week it's Lucy, I think next week it's Gina again. I help her out."
He rubbed his chin.
"I have to shave, though, otherwise I leave stubble marks in the lipstick. We have piles of dirty knickers in the bedroom. A bloke drops them off on a Thursday."
I couldn't help but laugh at the picture of him in front of the fire, kissing cards and packing knickers for the country's crotch sniffers. His head went back into cockerel mode.
"Yeah, well, like I said, it's only until the money comes in. They're really keen. Activision, the Tomb Raider lot, all the big boys. I'm just about to hit it big time, know what I mean?"
"Yes, I do, Tom." I knew exactly. I gave it one more try once we'd turned the corner into All Saints and Janice couldn't see us if she looked out. I stopped and faced him outside a window full of taps, waste pipes and assorted plumber's shit.
"Tom, think about this seriously. I'm not going to do anything that's wriggly. I'm too old for that sort of stuff. All I want to do is make some money the same as you. I need you with me, but I must know by tonight if you're up for it."
He was looking at the pavement, shoulders slumped.
"Yeah, but, you know..."
The cold was starting to get to him. I didn't know whether he didn't have a coat because they hadn't kissed enough cards, or if he was just too stupid to remember to put one on. We got to Westbourne Park Road, a main drag. I wanted a taxi, so I stood on the corner. He stood next to me, shifting from one foot to the other. I put a hand on his shoulder.
"Listen, mate, go and change some money and think about it, and we'll meet up tonight, all right?"
I started looking for cabs as he nodded at the pavement again. "I'll call you about 7-ish and we'll have a drink, okay?" A yellow light appeared in the gloom and I stuck out my hand. The cab stopped and the diesel engine chugged away, but not as fast as the meter. Tom was still stooped, hands dug deep in his pockets, shivering. I talked to the top of his head.
"Tom, this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance. Think hard about it."
The top of his head moved in what I took to be another nod. I couldn't stand his shivering any more and unzipped my jacket.
"For fuck's sake, put this thing on, will you?"
He protested feebly, then returned my grin as he took the coat. At least I could see his face now.
"Once in a lifetime, mate."
I got into the taxi, asked for Marble Arch, and turned to close the door and pull down the window. Tom was just finishing zipping up.
"Hey, Nick, bollocks to it. Why not? I'm up for it."
The cockerel had returned. I didn't want to show how pleased I was.
"That's good. I'll call you tonight with the details. We have to leave tomorrow, is that okay? You got a passport?"
"No probs."
"Excellent. Remember," I pointed to his cargoes, "there's plenty more where that came from. 1 week, maybe two, who knows?"
I put my thumb to my ear and little finger to my mouth to mime a call.
"Tonight at 7.
He did the same.
"Nice one.
Tom, one last thing. You have a credit card?
Yeah. Why's that?
I haven't got mine. You might have to pay for the tickets, but don't worry, I'll give you the cash before we go. I didn't give him time to think too much about that one. As the taxi pulled away, I was feeling pretty pleased with myself, and I had a sneaking suspicion that Tom wouldn't be sharing his newfound wealth with Janice. I knew I wouldn't if I was him. After giving the cab driver a new drop-off point, I bought myself a blue ski jacket in Oxford Street and went to a chemist's for some bits and pieces I'd need for the DLB, dead letterbox, so I could leave our details with Liv. Before E4 pinged me at the flat, I'd thought Liv, wanting to use a DLB just to hand over some flight details, was a bit paranoid. But now I knew it was essential. If E4 were onto her, I didn't want any more contact with her in the UK. The last thing I needed was for Lynn to have a picture of that on his desk. The shit would be so high I'd never be able to dig myself out. I booked the flights from a phone box, and they held them in Tom's name. I'd get him to pay for them with his credit card at the airport tomorrow. Now that Davidson was history, I had no choice. No one needed to know that Nick Stone was leaving the country. I wondered if Tom was still being monitored now that he was a known subversive, but decided I'd have to take that risk. There wasn't time to do anything about it. With my new coat to keep me warm, I decided I'd walk it to the DLB she'd given me. It wasn't that far away. Fighting my way through the Saturday shopping frenzy, I eventually made the 200 metres or so to Oxford Circus. The BBC studios in Portland Place were in front of me on the right. I stayed on the opposite pavement and headed for the Langham Hilton. About 50 metres short of the hotel, I walked under some scaffolding. Beneath it were two old-style red telephone boxes. In the windows of each were maybe 20 calling cards held in position by lumps of blue tack. The council would be around at some point today to clean them out, but they'd be restocked an hour later. I went into the left-hand box and saw Susie G's card, three-quarters of the way up, facing Oxford Circus. She looked very sultry, on all fours and kissing the air. At the same time as I peeled her off the glass, I got out a large black marker pen and scored a line down the window. Folding Susie into my pocket, I moved on towards the hotel. It was a bit premature to leave the DLB loaded sign, but I wasn't expecting any problems. With my bag in hand, I walked through the hotel's revolving doors, which had been started for me by a guy dressed in a green three-quarter-length tunic and something that looked like a cross between a turban and a beret on his head. He looked a right nugget. The interior of the Langham was very plush and very full of businessmen and wealthy-looking tourists. It was Indian-themed, with the chukka bar to my left as I walked into the marble reception area. Liv's instructions were perfect. To the right and up a few steps was the reception desk, and ahead of me was a restaurant come tea room. My destination, however, was the basement. Down below was every bit as plush as above. Air-conditioned and soft-carpeted, it housed the conference rooms and business centre. Standing on an easel outside the George Room, a black felt board with white press-on letters announced, "Management 2000 welcomes our conference guests." Passing it, and two wall phones that I would be coming back to, I headed for the toilets. Opposite the toilet doors were more phones, a cloakroom and a table rigged up with tea, coffee and biscuits. Sitting ready to serve were a black guy and a white woman, talking in that shifty tone that you just know means they're honking about the management. As soon as they saw me, they gave me their corporate smiles. I smiled back and headed for the gents. Sitting down in one of the cubicles, I took out a little plastic pill box from my boots bag. The sort that people use to hold their day's supply of vitamins, along with a pack of adhesive-backed Velcro patches. I stuck both a female and a male patch onto the pillbox, just in case she'd fucked up on what side to use. It would be embarrassing if it didn't stick. Inside the pillbox went a small scrap of paper with my message. Arriving 15:15, 12th. That was all that she needed to know. putting the boots bag back in my pocket and checking that the two little squares of Velcro were secure, I came out of the toilet, smiled again at the two people in the cloakroom, turned right and went back to the first two telephones I'd passed. They were positioned quite low down the wall, for the convenience of users in wheelchairs. I put the bag between my legs and shuffled the chair up closer to the phone. Liv had chosen well. Not too busy. No video cameras about, and a reason to be there. As I sat down, I got out a pound coin and Susie's card. Picked up the phone and dialed, wondering if Janice and Tom had done any lipstick cards for her lately. I wanted the display to show money being used up. Otherwise, it would look suspicious if anyone passed and saw that I'd been there a few minutes and was only pretending to make a call. It was a small detail, but they count. I used my right hand to keep the phone to my ear, waiting for Susie, and felt under the wooden veneer shelf below it with my left. In the far corner, there should be a large patch of Velcro that Liv had put there. As I fumbled about, the doors to the George room opened behind me and out surged a stream of Management 2000 delegates. As I listened to the ringing tone, I watched the herd move to their grazing area by the cloakroom. A young woman in her 20s sat on the chair next to me and put a coin in the box. An aggressive Chinese woman answered me. "Hello?" I could hear my fellow caller tap out her number as I replied. "Susie?" "No, you wait." I waited. The woman next to me started talking about her child, who needed picking up from nursery as she was going to be late. The person at the other end was obviously annoyed.
"That's not fair, Mum. It's not always the same excuse, and yes, of course she remembers what her own mother looks like. Kirk is home early tonight. He'll pick her up."
A man came from behind and placed his hand on her shoulder. She kissed it. His Management 2000 badge said David. Not quite the conference making her late home, then. The noise level doubled as people talked management over coffee. I found what I was looking for as I heard footsteps approaching the receiver at the other end. It was female Velcro. The soft bit, just as Liv had said. A very husky middle-aged voice picked up the phone.
"Hello? Can I help you, my love? Would you like me to run through the services?"
I ummed and ahed as the maid named the tariff for spending half an hour in France, Greece, and various other countries of the world with Susie. To spin out the call, I asked where Susie was based, and then for directions to the address near Paddington. "That's great," I said. "I'll think about it." I put the phone down, picked up the bag, moved the chair back, stood up and headed back the way I'd come. Leaving the woman telling her mother it absolutely would be the last time she'd have to do this. I turned before going through the doors, checked the box couldn't be seen from that level, and went upstairs. Gunga Din did his trick with the revolving doors, and I was back on the street. Turning right, I headed back the way I'd come. Last light was soon. By 4:30, it would be dark. All I had to do now was call Tom at 7 and tell him the timings for tomorrow morning's flight, then go and dump my leathers in a bin and my weapon in London's biggest armory, the River Thames. Chapter 15. Sunday, 12th of December, 1999. Tom stood in a different queue for immigration. I'd told him in the nicest way that he must keep away from me until we were in the arrivals lounge. Security and all that. He talked too much and too loudly to sit next to in an aircraft. We'd even checked in separately. He'd agreed with his usual, "No drama, mate. Gotcha." On the tube to Heathrow, he'd told me that Janice was fine about him going away. "I told her I had some work with my old mate Nick in Scotland," he said. "I told her straight." That version was about as straight as Elton John. Janice was probably severely pissed off that he was enjoying himself north of the border for 2 weeks, while she slaved away kissing cards for Lucy. I wondered if he'd said anything to her about the money, but didn't ask. I didn't want him sounding off about his plans for world domination in the world of IT. At least he hadn't wanted to drown himself in free alcohol on the way over. It seemed he didn't drink. A byproduct, maybe,
of serving a jail sentence. Just as well, because there would be none of that until we were back in the UK. He'd made an effort and smartened himself up a bit for the journey, which was good. I wanted him to resemble an average citizen, not look like food for customs to pull to one side for a slow once-over. He was still wearing my jacket, but had swapped the flared jeans for a new, normal pair, and he was also wearing a new red sweatshirt. However, he still had the same canvas daps on, and though he'd finished off by washing and combing his hair, he hadn't shaved. I watched him slap his jacket as if he were doing some sort of dance. This was the third time since leaving London that I'd seen him think he'd mislaid his passport. We got through immigration and customs, and there was no need to wait for suitcases. I'd told him that all he needed was a bit of soap and a toothbrush, and he could wash his underwear in the bath with him at night. The sliding doors opened to admit us separately into the arrivals hall. Tom didn't know it, but no one would be there to meet us yet. We weren't on the flight that arrived at 15:15. As I'd told Liv, we were on the 13:45. I always liked to be early in order to watch who might be waiting for me. Walking into an arrivals lounge to meet people I didn't know gave me the same feeling as knocking on a strange door, not knowing who or what was on the other side. We met up in the hall. Tom seemed to be feeling very laddish today, eyeing the women as they moved around the terminal.
"What now, mate? Where are we going?"
"We're a bit early for our pickup. Let's get a brew." We followed the signs to the coffee shop. The glass and steel terminal building wasn't packed, but busy enough for a Sunday. More with tourists than business traffic. I could see a dull, grey sky beyond the glass walls, with snow piled up at the roadside and ice hanging from parked vehicles. As we neared the cafe, Tom bouncing along at my shoulder like some younger brother, we passed two tall, blonde and beautiful women at a phone booth.
"Cool, check out the arse on that. I love these Nordic birds."
The two of them caught his drift and laughed to each other as they looked at us. I just walked on, embarrassed. They would have had him for breakfast. Tom seemed not to notice.
"Hey, Nick, do you know, there's more people up here who are on the internet and have mobiles than anywhere else. You know, per capita."
"That's interesting, Tom." For once, he had said something that was. He liked that.
"That's right, mate. Must be all that darkness up here. Fuck all else to do, I suppose."
I looked at him and smiled, even though the joke had been better first time round. His face beamed and his hamster cheeks nearly covered his eyes.
"These people are at the cutting edge, know what I mean?"
He caught up the step that separated us and whispered in my ear, his head jutting in time.
"That's why the photocopier know-how is here. I'm right, aren't I?"
I was bored but managed to reply. "It's probably the long hours of darkness. There's nothing else to do but Xerox, I suppose. Coffee, Tom?"
"Nah, tea. Herbal or fruit if they have it."
We were soon at a table, me with coffee, Tom with a pot of hot water and an apple-flavoured tea bag wrapped in foil. Opposite was a bank of screens, obviously internet stations. It was only a matter of time before Tom saw them too, and I would be sitting alone, which wouldn't be a bad thing. His eyes lit up, and sure enough he was getting to his feet.
"I'm gonna have to go and check that out. You coming?"
He did, taking his tea with him. I didn't. He was back very quickly before I'd even tasted my coffee.
"You haven't got any coins, have you, mate?"
"I got no money. Well, finished money. Only dollars. Know what I mean?"
I hoiked out the change from the drinks as he grinned at his own joke. I decided to have a walk around to see if I could spot anything threatening. I'd shaken off E4, but Val obviously had enemies, and while I was working for him, that made them my enemies too. My documents always stayed with me. But there was something else I wanted from my holdall before I wandered off. Digging around for the leather zip-up organizer, I dropped both our bags at Tom's feet and headed for the departures lounge upstairs. There was nothing out of the ordinary. Nobody waffling into their lapels or facing into the crowd while pretending to read a newspaper. I took a walk outside, but not for long.
the cold biting into my face and hands. I hadn't seen anything that looked as if it was bad and intended for me. Back inside Arrivals and in the warm, there were a couple of boys in suits with A4 clear plastic folders showing the names of people they were there to collect. Tom was still in internet heaven.
"Look at this, Nick. Fucking cool, or what? Look, virtual Helsinki."
I was looking at a screen that displayed everything you needed to know about Helsinki, from street maps to images of hotels and booking facilities for travel or theatre tickets. There was even a route plan where you actually walked down a road as if you were in a game. Still, leaving the bags with him, I went and got myself another coffee, sat at the same table and watched and waited, thinking how lucky I'd been not to have had a kid brother that I'd had to drag around with me when I was growing up. 15 minutes later, he was back with the bags. He must have run out of money.
"I just emailed Janice and told her I definitely can't get in touch for a while. Up in the hills testing kit and all that."
I put the organiser back in my bag and finished my brew. "We might as well make a move. They should be here by now." Our lift was easy to spot. Smartly dressed in a grey suit and overcoat, with spiky light brown hair and a red complexion, presenting himself to the people pushing their trolleys through the automatic doors of the customs hall. He was holding up an A4 card with felt-tipped lettering on. "Nick and another." We went up and introduced ourselves. As we shook hands, he virtually stood to attention and clicked his heels together. Then he offered to take both our bags. Tom refused after I did. The short-term car park was opposite Arrivals. An aircraft roared overhead as we approached a silver Merc. Tom was impressed.
"Nice one."
We put the bags into the boot and got in the back. Spike turned the engine on and the radio blared. I assumed the two presenters were gobbing off in Finnish, but Tom looked at me.
"They're speaking Latin." "They're mad for it up here, mate. Don't know why, just are."
Spike turned it off.
I said, "How come you know so much about Finland?"
The Merc started moving.
"Got on the net last night and had a look, didn't I?"
"Are you going to bore for England the whole week?" He looked at me, not knowing if it was an insult, then made up his mind and smiled.
"Nah, mate, just thought you'd like to know."
He sat back into his seat. He was wrong. I wasn't joking. We followed the road signs. They were in Swedish as well as Finnish, the Swedes having ruled here in the past as well as the Russians. The motorway tarmac was immaculately clear of snow and ice. The airport was quite close to Helsinki, and we were soon on the city ring road. On both sides of us were low-level industrial units and large piles of cleared snow. I had to smile as I thought of the UK, where a couple of snowflakes bring the entire nation to a halt. Here they had snow for months, and the country didn't miss a beat. I saw a sign that said, St. Petersburg, 381 kilometres. Within 3 or 4 hours, we could be out of one of the wealthiest and most advanced places on Earth and entering a city of chaos and anarchy. But I didn't have to worry. We followed the slip road and moved onto another motorway, the E75, and started to head away from the built-up area such as it was. The small floating bull compass that was stuck on the dash told me we were generally heading north. Every vehicle on the motorway had its lights on. It was the law. We cruised comfortably along the motorway, passing through pine forests, snow and impressive cuts into massive granite outcrops. I looked over at Tom, who was resting his head on the seat, his eyes closed and his Walkman earphones in. I decided to take his cue and sit back and relax, though I kept my eyes on the road signs. Lahti and Mikkeli seemed to be likely targets, and after just under an hour it was quite clear where we were heading. We took the Lahti exit. The town was dominated by two very tall Eiffel Tower-like structures, both painted red and white, their spires obscured by the cloud cover, and with aircraft warning lights flashing away on all sides. The place was heaving with both traffic and people. It was a winter sports town. A ski jump towered over the houses, and as we started to rumble down the cobblestones of the main shopping area,
I saw that even pensioners were using cross-country poles instead of walking sticks. The inhabitants of Lahti were obviously in love with concrete and steel. Instead of traditional wooden dwellings with maybe a reindeer or two parked up outside, they went for new model Saabs, 4x4s and a blaze of Christmas decorations. We turned left by the town square and passed a brightly lit market, steam rising above the mass of canvas and nylon stall covers. Kitted out to stand in the cold all day, the traders looked more like astronauts. We slowed down almost immediately, at a sign telling us we were at the Alexi Hotel. Cutting left over the pavement, we stopped by a garage door that instantly started to open. A group of mothers with tricycle buggies walked around the back of the Merc before bumping back up onto the walkway. We drove quite fast, down a steep concrete ramp into a large, badly lit underground parking area. Puddles of water covered the floor where snow and ice had melted off the vehicles already here, and just about every car had skis strapped to its roof rack. We cruised about, looking for a space. Tom was sitting up now, earphones out and eyes wide.
"It's like one of them spy films, Nick. Know what I mean?"
His tone changed as he thought about what he'd just said.
"It's all right, innit? I mean, you know what's happening, don't you?"
I nodded, not really feeling too sure. Nosy parking in a vacant space, Spike turned off the engine and swiveled round in his seat.
"Please, are your phones, your pages, and your email devices?"
he said in heavily accented English.
"You must leave them here. No worry, you get them back."
He smiled, showing a not-so-good set of teeth. I explained that, as instructed, neither of us had brought any. He smiled again.
"Good. Thank you, thank you."
The boot clicked open behind us as Spike pulled on the lever next to his seat. I got out of the car and Tom followed, just as a black 4x4 Mercedes, the old square shape, moved slowly towards us. The glare of its headlights prevented me seeing who was inside. I looked at Spike, who didn't seem remotely concerned. The 4x4 stopped, its engine running. It had blacked-out rear windows, and the only occupant I could see was the driver. She looked very different from the last time I'd seen her. Then she'd resembled an off-duty Italian. Now she was wearing a chunky grey Norwegian-style polo neck, which came right up to her chin, decorated with weird and wonderful patterns. A Tibetan hat with ear flaps covered most of the rest of her face, but I could just make out some wisps of blonde hair. As the front window slid down, I was treated to a very pleasant but businesslike smile.
"Get in the back of the vehicle quickly, please,"
she added something in Finnish to Spike, and he shook his head back to her as we climbed into the rear seats with our bags. The vehicle was cold. She must have been waiting for us without the engine running or the heater on.
"Please sit well down in your seats and keep away from the windows."
Tom looked at me for an explanation. I shrugged. "Later, mate." I turned back to face the windscreen and saw Liv watching me in the rearview mirror. She smiled.
"Welcome to Finland."
She then tilted her head to look at Tom.
"My name is Liv. I'm very pleased to meet you."
Tom nodded, looking almost shy. She clearly had the same effect on him as she did on me. He turned to glance at his reflection in the blacked-out window, probably wishing he'd combed his hair. We drove back out onto the road, turning left. The lights burned even brighter in the marketplace. It was getting quite dark.
"We don't have a lot of time," Liv said. "Events have moved on from our last conversation. You must carry out the task this Tuesday."
Another of their minor complications. I didn't believe her. I bet that this had always been the timing Val wanted. But instead of telling me in case it put me off, she'd just bullshitted. "I need to see the target," I said. "Tonight isn't a lot of time for preparation. You'll have to tell me all you know tonight, and I'll recce the place tomorrow."
"Yes," Of course. I am also concerned that Tom should have enough time to break through the firewall, so he can access the system.
Tom sat up, like a well-behaved child trying to please an adult.
It'll be okay. Just show me what you got. I will, Tom. Very soon.
There was a long pause as Tom sank back into the seat. I looked at the road.
Where are we going now?
It's not far. By the lakes.
That wasn't much of a clue. The whole country was covered with the things. The black and yellow fluorescent sign of a town silhouette with a red line through it told me I was now out of Lahti. We hit a good quality single carriage road, lined at first with houses, their Christmas decorations glowing in the darkness, then giving way to trees and cuts through granite once again. Another sign told me that Mikkeli was now 106 kilometres away. We must still be heading north. I kept my eyes on the odometer as we passed a succession of plastic pedal bin mailboxes on posts, all neatly aligned by the roadside. The only sign that somewhere deep in these forests lay habitation. The cloud cover and closeness of the trees made darkness fall on us completely. The reflection from the clean white snow almost doubling the effectiveness of the headlights. The 4x4 Merc soon warmed up, and Tom had his earpieces in and eyes closed. I found myself trying to think of things to say to Liv, but small talk wasn't on her agenda. There was far more checking of mirrors than was required for normal driving. She was carrying out anti-surveillance. That was why we'd met in the car park and come straight out before any connection could be made between the two vehicles. If anybody had been following us from the airport, they would naturally have assumed we were going into the hotel. I could see her face illuminated by the dash as I sat up. Liv, why all the fuss about telephones and pages? And why the dead letterbox?
The old ways are the best,
she smiled.
A Sicilian once told me that, to be sure, there's a future, you must